You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, in for Lizzie O'Leary, who's on assignment. This week, your stories about how money has changed your neighborhood. Heather Havrileski takes the Marketplace quiz. And if you're listening to us while stuck in traffic, we'll take a look at why that traffic actually happens. It may not get you where you're going any faster, but well, at least you'll know. As always, if you have thoughts for us, come share them on marketplace.org or on our Facebook page or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. We're starting off with our segment Long and Short. That's where we take a position on current events. But in the language of finance, things we like are long. Things we're kind of iffy about, they're short. This week, we have Marketplace's Raghu Manavalan and Hamilton Nolan, formerly of Gawker, now at Deadspin. Welcome to you both.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hamilton, let's talk to you. What are you long this week?
This week, I'm long on pensions and specifically the pension crisis, which is a slow motion crisis that's like a field of lava coming down a volcano that everybody knows is going to eat the developed world at some point. Specifically, pensions are facing both a demographic challenge, which is too many old people and fewer younger workers, and a changing global economy, which means pensions cannot earn the kind of investment returns they used to. And it all adds up to what will be a huge political, economic, and social fiasco at some point.
And you're long on that.
Well, I'm long on it as a journalist, in that it's great.
That
it's going to be a great
disaster
to write about.
Yes. It'll keep you employed for a couple more years.
Exactly.
Right?
He's long on the fact that it's going to make a lot of news.
You could spend your adult life writing disaster stories about pensions, probably.
So, yeah, but as you correctly noted, Hamilton, because it's a slow-moving crisis, it's very hard for the public to mobilize itself into the crisis mode necessary to do something. Social Security, a similar thing. Medicare, a similar thing. Right. And so it's very troubling that we're not seeing solutions coming to the fore.
Well, the fact is that at some point it's going to hit crisis mode when pensions literally run out of money and stop being able to pay people. And at that point, it will degenerate into a political war. And hopefully, after all the nasty political war goes on, people can sit down and figure out that we need to sort of build a better public retirement system in this country.
Or with more private companies now with 401ks, this is a public sector problem, and we might see more municipal bankruptcies as a result of this.
No doubt, but you know, 401ks are not going to solve the pension problem in the sense that the era of lower economic growth and lower investment returns is going to hit 401ks just as bad as it hit pensions. I mean, the bigger problem is people are not going to have enough money to retire on, and we're going to have to decide as a country what we want to do about that.
All right. So if you're long the apocalypse, what are you short on?
I'm short on Ryan Lochte, the Olympic swimmer.
Get so in line.
Almost positive has peaked at this point. And my main takeaway from the entire Ryan Lochte story was I felt sorry for diplomats because I imagine that, you know, people get into diplomacy and working for the State Department to kind of bring peace to the world. And then they end up just dealing with Ryan Lochte in Brazil.
So I found it to be a teachable moment. I turned to my kid and I said, you will always get caught. Always. I don't understand why Ryan Lochte doesn't know that.
See, I got to say, there's a solid like buy low opportunity here. You know, America loves a redemption story. Maybe in 4 years, he cleans up his act. He gets rid of the goofy haircut. Maybe he sets a world record, you know, gets on a Wheaties box. I don't know. I can see it.
You see Lance Armstrong coming back too?
I wouldn't be surprised.
All right. The great American dream right there. So, Raghu, what are you long on?
I guess this kind of fits into pensions pretty well. I'm long collective bargaining and unionizing. You guys might have heard that unions have taken some hits over the last 50 years or so, but the National Labor Relations Board ruled this week that Columbia grad students could actually unionize as students. This only covers private schools, not public schools, but, you know, it's a step in that direction. We've talked a little bit on this show before about how unions haven't really covered jobs that Americans have anymore. It used to be like manufacturing or like blue-collar jobs. I mean, the United Auto Workers are the ones that are going to be covering Columbia. Seems like an odd fit, but, you know, we'll see where it goes. Gawker, RIP, voted to unionize.
Yes.
UFC fighters might be unionizing. I mean, we're going from, like, assembly line workers to combat athletes and grad students.
Yeah, but the sad reality is organized labor is gradually diminishing and dwindling.
Oh, yeah.
Has nowhere near the clout it used to
have. Absolutely. I mean, membership is at its lowest point probably in the last 50 or 60 years. But part of that problem was these unions were fighting for those sectors of jobs that just weren't here anymore. Like manufacturing just wasn't here anymore. It's interesting to see how they're like, maybe we need to start representing students. Maybe we need to start representing other exploited classes.
So does that represent a turnaround for organized labor, or is it more of a last gasp?
I would call it a pivot. Tons of employees feel exploited or feel like they don't have protection in the workplace. These people want voices.
Hamilton, you guys were organized at Gawker, right?
Yes, and could not agree more on this. You know, the big picture to me is the more economic inequality goes up, the more unions make sense to workers in every industry. And so I am absolutely long unions to bet on it.
All right, Raghu, what are you short on?
This is sad, but I'm short on the National Park System. We're actually celebrating the 100th birthday of the system this week.
Mazel tov.
Pretty cool, yeah. 300 million people went to a national park last year, also pretty cool. We're about $12 billion short on necessary maintenance, which is kind of a bummer.
Wait, $12
billion? $12 billion with a B.
That's a lot of park benches.
That's a lot of Nalgene water bottles, I suppose, left back in some of those parks. You know, this week, I don't know if you guys saw, but the Chicago White Sox announced that their new stadium would be called the Guaranteed Rate Field. I feel like we could maybe take a step from the private sector. Maybe AT&T Park at Yosemite.
Ooh.
Maybe DoubleTree at Joshua Tree.
Not sure.
I don't know.
I'm feeling
we
got to
start
that.
Making some money for these parks, guys.
Wow. Petco presents. I mean, it's just. And yet, you're probably right. I mean, naming rights, corporate affiliations. It's hard to. I mean, you know, it's like robbing banks. You go where the money is.
There you go.
And this seems like one
pivot.
Of the ways. Hey, looking ahead very quickly to next week, do you guys feel optimistic about anything on the horizon?
Personally, no, since my website just went out of business. So I'm short on optimism at the moment. But the week after that, yes, back to optimism again.
Yeah, and luckily you've got catastrophic news to keep covering, so you're good.
Yeah, that's right. I've got the pension crisis to keep me employed for the rest of my career.
Raghu?
I'm flying out to Rochester, New York to cover the decline in manufacturing in the United States.
Rock
so
on.
That'll be a fun time for everyone.
This has been the long and the short, and we've certainly gone long and short with our friends Hamilton Nolan, formerly of Gawker, now of Deadspin, and Raghu Madhavan, a producer here at Marketplace. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It isn't news that there's been a drop in manufacturing employment, but what may come as a surprise is that the jobs that have left the United States to relocate south of the border actually have some benefits to workers here in the U.S. L.A. Times California economy reporter Natalie Kitroev recently wrote about how American workers were being lifted by Mexico's manufacturing boom. Natalie, welcome to the program.
Hi, David.
Good to see you here.
It's nice to see you here.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so I'm reading your story that you had in the paper the other day talking about how car jobs that used to be in the U.S., they're now down in Mexico, and they're producing a robust Mexican middle class, which isn't a surprise. What is surprising is the rising tide down there is lifting U.S. boats.
Right. So, I mean, what you've been hearing on the presidential campaign trail from candidates on both sides is that NAFTA is killing U.S. jobs, that it's the worst trade deal in history, says Trump. Even Hillary Clinton, who was once sort of supportive of the deal, has been super critical. And so what we tried to do here is to look at that claim. And what we found and what research, both theoretical research, but also practical experience from CEOs on both sides of the border shows is that actually what's going on is much more complex than what you're hearing. And the boom in manufacturing in Mexico is sustaining many U.S. supplier jobs because of the way that supply chains are structured through North America.
And what surprised me here is, even though we think of U.S. manufacturing jobs as dwindling and evaporating, in fact, we're adding jobs.
Well, we are. We are in the process of adding jobs since the recession. I mean, we're not at the peak of 19 million plus jobs in the late 70s. There is a pretty clear sense that we will never return to that peak, that the type of manufacturing that's coming back to the United States is much more machine driven. But yes, we've seen an uptick in 6% since the recession, since 2009 in manufacturing jobs. And more to the point, our manufacturing output is almost at a record high. So what's happening when you hear Obama talk about a manufacturing renaissance is that we are producing more than ever. A lot of the kind of irony that you hear economists talk about when they hear the concern about manufacturing in the United States is that we in the U.S. are in the middle of our own sort of mini boom.
And yet that's not to mitigate the fact that American workers in the manufacturing sector are going through some difficult times, and many of them have lost jobs that aren't coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about 5 million jobs, you know, since 2000. And in many cases, these are folks who are older, who don't have a ton of advanced education. And so it's very hard for them to see how these trade deals are benefiting them, because they, in many cases, have not been able to move into kind of higher paying or more advanced skilled jobs. So it's a paradox where we're seeing this boom in output, and yes, the jobs are sort of slowly following, but, you know, the broader picture is really grim for a huge cohort of workers.
So what we're seeing in that case, and in many cases, is the lower-end jobs leaving this country, the assembly jobs, for example, that have a lot of human component to it that can be very expensive in the U.S., and in theory, higher-end jobs taking their place. But is that, in fact, playing out across the entire sector?
It's playing out across the entire manufacturing sector. Lower-paying jobs, we're talking about people picking up things, putting them in boxes, closing the boxes. That type of work has left the United States. What has shifted back to the United States is more advanced manufacturing jobs. Part of the reason why there are fewer manual labor jobs in manufacturing is that there's been a technological revolution, and now robots do a lot of the work that humans used to do. You know, it's remarkable that automation is a very real and kind of pervasive force that's changing manufacturing, not just in the U.S., but also in Mexico. So from an economic standpoint, as soon as we can shift towards a workforce that is able to kind of work with robots, program them, maintain them, we will have an advantage in what is going to be just the future of manufacturing across the globe.
And luckily, we'll see no such automation in the journalism industry.
Yeah, no, thank God. Yeah, no.
Cough. Natalie Kitroev covers the California economy for the LA Times. Natalie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Last week, we asked you how money has changed your community, and many of you called and wrote in with mixed feelings. We're keeping that conversation going this week. And now, some more of your stories. David Leslie is 28, born and raised in Fairbanks, Alaska. Earlier in the year, the Alaskan government formalized plans to bring F-35 fighter jets to the military base near Fairbanks and to begin construction on the related facilities in 2017. It's a deal that is thought to represent nearly $1.3 billion in annual revenue for the community. But David and some other residents aren't so thrilled.
A lot of people are excited. All of our politicians and, you know, a large part of our community are military and support it. But I'm afraid that once they get here, they're going to build a lot of new infrastructure like Taco Bells, Hot Topics, more national hotel chains. And once those are there, Alaska's kind of facing a huge budget crisis right now, and I'm not sure if these new fighter jets will be able to save it from eventually having lots of people leave, and we'll be stuck with all these new buildings built for the 3,000 people coming with the jets, and we won't be able to keep them heated or find use for them, and we'll just have a bunch of empty buildings in the middle of nowhere.
Or is it possible that you'll just get a new breed of Fairbank resident, millennials, others who might follow all that development?
That's very true. We are seeing an influx of new people. You know, they come up here and they know places like Walmart, and they go and shop there instead of the local mom-and-pop grocery stores. And that's definitely changing the way this town is. We have a Barnes & Noble and Home Depot and Lowe's, all these places didn't exist when I grew up here.
Would you call that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know, they're nice businesses. I really enjoy their products, but it's also not the Fairbanks I grew up in. And it's weird to see that happening.
Do you imagine you're going to be there for life?
You know, I should probably, get out and see the rest of the world, having lived here my entire life. And I want to stay here and keep trying to change it for the ways I believe are best. But if it's getting too hard to live here with our budget crisis, it would definitely make sense to leave.
David Leslie, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Then there are people like Angela Moraney. She's 55 and lives in Milwaukee. Money is moving into the city, but not necessarily to the places that need it most. Angela's hopeful that things will turn around.
Well, money usually improves a lot of things. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the ruckus that's been going on. It happened a couple weeks ago. It was a little riot where people burned some buildings, and it has been traced back to the frustration of the socioeconomic divide here.
We've seen other urban and metropolitan areas where once there is some turnaround in the economy, there is some turnaround in the fortunes of the neighborhood, then you get gentrification. And not to put too fine a point on it, but that can push people of color out of the area in which they grew up.
The thing about Milwaukee is, with all of our dysfunctionality, we have people in really nice places. Like, we have a new Common Council president. We have some young African-American male aldermen that were just elected. Actually, one is a young male, and another is a young black female. And what it has been doing is been diversifying Milwaukee. You have the affordable low-income tax credits. They call it the affordable housing tax credits now, where you actually can put very new developments, or you can renovate developments and have affordable and market rate rents in the central city. But what we are finding is, of course, there are overwhelmingly black residents, but there are white residents moving into those developments as well.
Angela, if you're not working for the Chamber of Commerce, you've missed your calling in life.
Actually, I own a gourmet salsa company. We're actually the only black-owned gourmet salsa company in the country. It's called That Salsa Lady.
How spicy is it?
The only thing that's spicy is our death wish.
So if you could give me a slogan for Milwaukee that would get me to come in and spend some time there, what would it be?
Come on down. You're welcome.
Angela Moraney, thanks so much for talking to us.
All right, bye.
Angel Lazo is 43. He lives in Homestead, Florida. Homestead was ravaged by Hurricane Andrew in 1992. Angel says that since then, the influx of money has revitalized the city, and the continued growth is a good thing.
I think that our city has grown. When I first moved in, there was only one public supermarket, which is the largest supermarket in the state of Florida, the supermarket chain, that is. And now we have three within the city limits, and that to me was a great improvement. And I see the growth in that sense. And then you have more housing and a new hospital. And we just had the new city hall built, and also a new police station that's being built with bonds. So you can see the growth. You can see where the money is going to reinvest into the city. So there's obviously demand for new housing, new centers of work, people coming in and wanting services from the city.
Have you found the city becoming depersonalized or impersonal anyway as a result of all this growth? Or have you found that these have all been steps in the right direction?
I find that it's a step in the right direction in the sense that the city has grown, but it hasn't lost that hometown feeling. Actually, the city's motto, or unofficial motto, is like, Homestead is home. I don't feel that I want to leave that hometown feeling that we have.
So what's your advice to other cities that might be experiencing the influx of money that we're talking about and are facing some of these issues?
Well, in my advice is, find out what you do best. I think for us, we capitalize on the fact that our city is situated between two national parks. So we play on our strengths and work on our shortcomings. One of our shortcomings is the fact that the city has about 30% poverty. And that's still really significant, and a median income of about $40,000. But I think you need to capitalize on what you can, on what is that you have. Play your strengths and work on your shortcomings.
Homestead is home.
Absolutely.
Angel Lazo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As we've heard, gentrification and the effects of money in communities, it's complicated. And that's why we're turning to an expert. Manuel Pastor is the director of the Program for Environmental and Regional Equity at the University of Southern California. Welcome, Manuel.
Glad to be with you.
Clearly, what we're hearing from a number of the people who have contacted us after we posed that question was money changes the community, good and bad, and it looks like different flavors of gentrification. Is that basically playing out?
Yeah, when we think about gentrification, some of it is appreciated by people who live in the neighborhoods because when it brings amenities like food stores and restaurants and services and often better police protection, that's deeply appreciated by people who already live in those neighborhoods. What they resent is when gentrification also brings displacement of local commerce that serves them, of residents who can no longer afford the rent. What they wind up feeling like is the neighborhood is improving, but the people are leaving.
And that seems as though, even though obviously for the people being pushed out, a bad thing, it still seems to be something that we've been watching for decades in U.S. urban environments. Anytime money spills into the neighborhood, you're going to undergo this transformation.
We've seen that for some time. So gentrification and indeed displacement are not new phenomena. But there's sort of three drivers that are really important in the contemporary era. One is that the economy has shifted in a way that values innovation industries, creative industries. That tends to drive up rents and push people out. The second big force is demographic. And in particular, what many people thought it would be older retirees without kids moving back to cities. That's part of the phenomena. But another part of it is millennials who no longer see that buying a house in the suburbs is a way to acquire assets, particularly after the financial crash. They're staying in cities, but when they stay, that adds to the rent pressure as well. And then finally, policy. You know, city governments have been trying to promote their downtown development, get residential settlement in places like downtown LA or Seattle, et cetera. That's starting to work, and some of the costs of success are these pressures of gentrification, which are displacing long-term residents who've really stuck it out in these communities.
Is there a way to have the best of both worlds, to have your Whole Foods and your Starbucks and also affordable housing?
Well, I think the problem is that the policy tools to try to resist the displacement are somewhat limited. We can do community land trusts, which is essentially taking land off of the market and putting it in trust so that its values won't rise. Rent control and rent stabilization are really key in building more affordable housing. It's difficult to get the resources for community land trusts. There's a lot of opposition against rent control, particularly from apartment owners, and it's expensive to build affordable housing, and you often run into the challenges of people saying, not in my neighborhood. So I think all of those things make gentrification and displacement pretty difficult to deal with in a policy framework, but it is really the central issue right now of our comeback cities. What does it mean when cities are coming back from the decay of decades ago, but as they come back, the people who stuck it out are being forced to leave? It's a big dilemma.
Yet from a policy level, it often seems as though people in a position to make these decisions are more responsive to commercial interests. They will offer the tax breaks. They will offer the zoning changes that are necessary to bring in a Whole Foods, for example, or a Starbucks or a what have you, because of the jobs that will come with it, because of the effect that will have in the neighborhood in terms of bringing everybody else up. And yet when you see decisions for affordable housing, for rent control, those are decisions that seem to just go on and on and on.
It's true that we face, as I was mentioning, some challenges with whether or not we've got the appropriate policy tools that are powerful enough to deal with the gentrification pressures. But really, fundamentally, gentrification is about power. It's when a community lacks the economic power to be able to participate in the gains that are occurring there when those jobs arrive, or when it lacks the political power to force the local policymakers to do the land trusts, to stabilize the rents, to do the affordable housing around the new transit stations. For every Whole Foods, there's a taqueria that got displaced. For every $8 donut, there's a nail shop that might be forced out. We need to be paying attention to how we build these business corridors in a way that serves the existing populations and still deals with the fact that people do want to move back into cities. And that is a good thing for the development of cities and for the strength of urban economies.
How responsive have you found policymakers to the things you're saying right now?
I think policymakers are in the process of beginning to shift gears. You know, when we talk often about urban policy, we tend to think about it in terms of problems of 20 years ago, decline and distress and disinvestment. The urban policy challenges today are the cities coming back and the fact that there's so much activity happening in our central cities and the fact that metropolitan areas capture so much of the national economy. So my hope is that policymakers shift their paradigm from the past to the future and move from trying to think about gentrification where it's occurring to where it's about to occur, because that's where our policy tools will be the most effective.
Manuel Pastor is director of USC's Program for Environmental and Regional Equity. Mr. Pastor, thank you so much for joining us.
Been a pleasure.
In 2014, Marketplace took a deep look at how new money can change a neighborhood, focusing on one in particular, the Highland Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. We set up a pop-up bureau at the main intersection of the neighborhood at York and Figueroa. You can hear and see the results by visiting yorkandfig.com. Next week, we want to hear your stories about money and education. Are you spending on yourself? Are you spending on your kids? What have you learned or figured out? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org or chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Just do a search for Marketplace Business News or call 1-800-648-5114. While the Olympics were still happening, I found out about Usain Bolt's 200-meter gold medal win on Twitter in the afternoon. And then when I got home and turned on the TV that night, they were teasing Bolt's race as if it hadn't even happened. Will Usain Bolt prevail in the 200 meters? Yeah, he will. He has. Come on. Well, that's the problem that NBC faced this year while covering the Rio Games. Marketplace's Molly Wood is here to talk about TV coverage in the age of social media. Molly, I kind of feel like NBC could have done this thing a whole lot better.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that there's a pretty big delta between figuring out how to live stream sports on television and figuring out how not to pretend that you're in real time, which I think is the biggest mistake that NBC made. You really can't have it both ways.
And yet they tried to, and it seemed like every night in primetime, they were packaging the Olympics as if there was a lot of drama and suspense hanging over the games. And I think for many people who were interested in the games, they already knew the results to virtually everything.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that honestly, David, was just a poor programming decision, because they did put a lot of effort and money into live streaming. People clearly demonstrated by not watching the primetime broadcasts, for the most part, that they liked the live streaming, that that was a positive way to consume things. And there was definitely a way to combine both of those good things. Lots of live streaming, so people are up to date, and an interesting primetime broadcast that says, you probably already know what happened, but here's how great it is. Or here's a look at some of the interesting sports that happened that you maybe didn't see on the live stream. Like, there was still a way to make great primetime programming that didn't try to pretend you didn't already know.
So how does a broadcaster, how does an advertiser deal with this environment? Are we seeing all the viewing growth online now, or is primetime still kind of sacrosanct?
I suspect that what we will find, especially as all of these experimentations with live streaming sports come out, football games on Twitter, NBA original content on Twitter that's not games, maybe some more streaming on YouTube or Facebook, what we are likely to see is that most people, especially most people who maybe have jobs, are going to watch television, and they're going to watch it during the hours they normally watch television. It's really just a matter of balancing the information with the time constraints. So you'll see a lot more live streaming as a supplement. You'll see advertising move there, but it doesn't devalue those TV commercials, which are still the most valuable advertising space that exists across the spectrum, whether it's radio, digital, or TV.
In the non-amateur sports world, the answer from advertisers has been to try and seek more product placement in shows, to try and get around the DVR problem by inserting themselves within the content of the show. Will we see more of that in sports?
Absolutely. And in fact, there are already discussions about NBA jerseys having ads on them. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if you start to see sports look a lot more like NASCAR, which long ago solved this problem by festooning vehicles with ads. I think that certainly as live streaming starts to eat into traditional TV revenue and viewership, and it will, even though those primetime ads will still be valuable, you will absolutely start to see more and more creative ways to try to keep that revenue up. It may include different kinds of subscription packages. It may include, like you said, a lot more product placement. I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see that within the next year or so.
The next three games, winter and summer, are all in Asia, which means things are going to be happening live when most Americans are asleep. NBC has to be thinking, oh my God, this is the worst possible scenario.
It kind of is the worst possible scenario, and I have to say that I don't envy them. I'm certainly not going to sit here and say I have the answer to doing that. Interestingly, one of the arguments NBC made about its primetime coverage this year was that people like to see the stories of the Olympics. They didn't actually do a great job of presenting that. There are wonderful stories that happened at the Olympics that you only saw on Twitter and that you only saw in the live stream. And I think this is an opportunity for NBC to stop pretending that we don't already know the outcome of these sporting events and lean into that storytelling. If that's really what they think people value, give us better stories. I don't want to see quarterfinal. I don't want to see any more qualifying events in prime time. That's just silly.
See, I was just the opposite.
Oh, really?
For me, I didn't know the results of any of the quarterfinals. I didn't know the results of any of the semis. It was only the finals that I knew going into it, so I could appreciate just the artistry of the sports by watching the events and the preliminaries that I didn't know anything about.
See, now maybe that's the way to do it. Either way, NBC should be listening to one or both of us because clearly a lot of creative solutions are going to be required. Maybe they should start focus testing now.
There we go. Molly Wood is Marketplace's gold medal winning senior tech correspondent. Molly, thank you so much.
My pleasure, David.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. And now it's time for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we bring in musicians, writers, other well-known people, and we ask them questions about work and money and how it's shaped their lives or taught them important lessons. Here's Marketplace producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest.
Hi, my name is Heather Havrileski, and I write the Ask Polly advice column for New York Magazine. I'm also the author of a brand new book called How to Be a Person in the World.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
I just keep thinking lipstick. My new obsession is lipstick. All I want whenever I am out and about is a new shade of lipstick. It's the strangest thing. I haven't worn lipstick since I was about 24 years old. I used to wear this MAC lipstick called Tramp, I think, or Slut. Lipstick is expensive, too, but I feel like it's almost like a buying candy for me now. I feel immediate thrill at owning a new shade of lipstick, and it doesn't have to look good on me. I don't even care anymore. If it looks strange, all the better.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
One of the best things about my job and one of the hardest things about my job is that when you're a freelance writer, like I am, you have some editors who are like your best friend that saves you from sounding like an idiot. And then you sometimes work with random editors who can be like your worst enemy who wants you to sound like an idiot. Which, I mean, it's very rare. I am mostly very lucky. But the kind of merry-go-round of editors that you get into when you write freelance pieces can be kind of intense.
What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
The main thing that comes to mind is the most expensive thing I ever bought. When I was 32, I was going through a really hard breakup, and I had just purchased a house. I'd taken my entire worldly life savings and put it into a down payment on a house. And because I was feeling a little reckless, I immediately took out a home equity loan and bought a Lexus with it, which is really stupid. I met with a financial planner, and the financial planner said, you know, I said, I've owned my car for 10 years, and I'm thinking of getting another Honda. And he said, that's so smart. If you're going to hold on to it for 10 years, that's great. Or you can get a used luxury car. And I was like, really? It's sensible to buy a used luxury car? So I immediately went out and I was like, I'm going to buy a Lexus. My dad died when I was 25 years old, and he was singing the praises of Lexus and had just bought a Lexus right before he died. And I drove his Lexus around Durham, North Carolina right after he died. And it was kind of like a way of being in touch with him and missing him to drive that crazy, insanely nice car around town. It was a giant mistake. I loved it. I called it my year of luxury at the time. And then it broke down about 15 times, and it cost me a lot of money. You know it's not right. Like, I knew all about the stupidity of having a home equity loan finance my car. I knew a lot of things, but I didn't care. There are lots of emotions and regrets are mixed up in that purchase.
What is your most prized possession?
I have a teddy bear I've had since I was about 1 year old that I just love. And I used to have nightmares about losing my teddy bear. I guess I've kind of transferred my teddy bear energy onto my kids and my dogs now, because I have nightmares about the dogs getting lost or something happening to the kids instead of the teddy bear. But I think the teddy bear was kind of my first inkling of that kind of feeling of, this is my most important thing, and if anyone ever does anything to this bear, my life will be ruined. Is that a prized possession? I don't know. It's almost like that's just a bundle of ragged teddy bear anxiety.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
I guess the piece of advice that I could always use, and sometimes followed much with great rewards, is follow your instincts. I think the one thing that my mom taught me as a kid was, you should never be miserable in any job. Life is too short to be miserable at a job. And I've always kind of, I've never allowed myself to stick with things that are making me unhappy, job-wise, career-wise. So I needed to be reminded of that when I was younger at times. When you're pursuing certain career goals and they just feel worthless and you don't like it and you're not, you know, and even everyone around you is saying, but that's such a great job. How could you ever leave that job? But you just want to leave the job. It just does not feel valuable to you. You got to leave that job. It sounds a little bit crazy. It's a little bit like financing a Lexus with your home equity loan to say, leave any job that's making you miserable. But, you know, you're going to have a lot of different jobs throughout the course of a career. That's the way careers are these days. And it's good to explore. It's good to have new experiences. It's so good. It's so good for a writer, or anyone creative in particular, to take risks. So I would say, follow your instincts and be bold. Mighty forces will come to your aid.
Heather Havrileski's book, How to Be a Person in the World, is out now. Listening to Marketplace Weekend, and next weekend, it's the Labor Day holiday, and an estimated 35 million Americans are expected to travel. Ouch. And 86% of them, they're going to be filling up their gas tanks to make the trip by car. AAA estimates that it costs about 57 cents a mile to drive. But with so many people on the road, well, a lot of that fuel is going to be wasted idling in traffic. So you're wondering, is there a fix? Benjamin Siebold is a professor at Temple University who studies traffic. Benjamin, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So traffic jams. I mean, it's obviously not a Southern California phenomenon alone, although we seem to have the worst in the world, thank you very much. But these things are like living organisms, and yet it's hard to understand where do they come from.
Absolutely. So, I mean, traffic jams are really fascinating as a collective system because it neither grew through like evolution, nor did we actually design it. So we built the roads, but we actually didn't design the drivers.
So let's go back to the example I just gave. And that's you're driving along and suddenly everything slows to a crawl and then the pace picks up again. What just happened there?
That's exactly the fascinating part. So that's what people call the phantom traffic jam phenomenon. As a driver, you suddenly have to brake because the person in front of you brake, and then you make the person behind you brake, but then you accelerate again, and then you're through. But when you look at it from the outside, you actually see a wave of brake lights that travels backwards along the road.
What it sounds like you're saying there is that if I slow down suddenly, that's because an hour earlier, somebody else tapped their brakes.
It's actually even more than that. It can be that you are actually completely unable to pinpoint who caused this phenomenon, who caused this wave. So it can really come out of small road imperfections, small engine hiccups, drivers like being inattentive for like a tenth of a second, stuff that you normally wouldn't notice. Once the uniform flow is unstable, these will amplify and develop into waves, but it's not possible to say this person caused it. And this makes it really interesting because it really means that even if everybody drove exactly the same way and drove perfectly, you could still, in principle, get these traffic waves. The key is how to break them, how to get rid of them, because they impose a sudden braking behavior, an unexpected braking, and that, of course, means they're hotspots for accidents. And also, of course, they result in lots of stop-and-go traffic, meaning the fuel consumption is substantially increased of the system.
How do you get your data? I can't imagine that you're asking people to just fill out forms. That would be too cumbersome.
So data collection is a major issue in traffic flow research. The traditional means of data collection is counting cars, so either by humans or by sensors in the road, cameras. A big breakthrough has happened just like 5 to 10 years ago with the emergence of the cell phone. So people now carry around GPS transmitters, and many people are willing to transmit their data. So we're getting now a surge of new data that allows us to see something. But one important part that is also crucial in the process is experiments. In 2008, a group of Japanese researchers conducted an experiment that was really insightful because they prepared a single-lane road, a circular road, had people drive around, and they were able to demonstrate that you get these waves that arise out of the nothing, essentially. They just grow and amplify, and eventually you get a wave, a stop-and-go wave that travels backwards on the road.
All right, so everybody else in L.A., you stop listening for a sec. Now, just between you and me, Professor Zeibold, how do I beat the system? How do I get to where I'm going faster than everybody else?
Well, the phantom traffic jams that we're talking about could be avoidable if people were to drive slightly differently. And the main problem, of course, is how can one get people to drive slightly differently? That is sort of the million-dollar question. In our research, we investigate some ideas in that direction.
All right. So what happens? If we all work together, obviously, you're telling me that traffic jams can be mitigated. So now everyone listening, what can we all do to make the world a better place?
Unfortunately, I have to be somewhat pessimistic because it is not clear how much individual drivers can really do successfully to eliminate the phenomenon and get rid of traffic waves. As a general rule, you could leave a little bit more headway, but not too much, because if you leave too much, then people cut in front of you. One possibility that is being done, especially in the LA area, is ramp metering. So you put traffic lights in the on-ramps, and when you have rush hour traffic, you try to limit the number of cars that enter the highway, and therefore could potentially keep traffic flow from entering that regime where you get these stop-and-go waves. What we are particularly interested in right now is autonomous vehicles. We're still quite a while away from a time when all the vehicles will be connected and self-driving, but we'll soon have a regime where we'll have a few autonomous vehicles. So what we're currently looking at is ideas, approaches, how one could use some of those self-driving vehicles that will be on the highways anyways to drive slightly differently from the humans, and therefore, in a way, work towards making the whole system behave better and more effectively.
We have been stopping and starting with Benjamin Zeibold. He's Associate Professor of Mathematics at Temple University. Mr. Zeibold, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
this upcoming Labor Day weekend, while you're sitting in all that traffic, hopefully you'll end up someplace that's happy. After all, that's what vacation spots are all about. Well, across the Atlantic, tourists are discovering a new place to go and find some happiness. You may not have heard of Lay-on-Sea, a small town in Essex on the east of England, but it topped a happiness survey of 2016 British regions. The BBC's Elizabeth Hodson reports.
If you can smile on rainy days, the sun will chase those clouds away, and then you will find you're on the road to happiness.
I'm in Lay-on-Sea, a small coastal town in the southeast of England. It's just been crowned the happiest place to live in Britain. By contrast, the area I live in, Islington in London, is apparently one of the most miserable, ranking 196 out of 206 places covered. So what makes Lay-on-Sea such a happy place to be?
I'm Carol Mitson. I've worked in Lay-on-Sea for 15 years. I work in a shellfish, we call it a cockle shed. It's an old-fashioned shellfish stall.
What is it about Lee that people who live here like?
They like the shellfish, they like to be able to sit by the sea, they like to be able to see the fishing boats coming in with their catch.
I've just come across a group of very happy swimmers. A rather dashing man in his swimming trunks has got out of the sea after what looks like a rather refreshing dip. So, what was the water like?
Everyone seems to think it's cold and it's filthy, but it's not. I've been swimming in here since I was a toddler and I'm still here.
Why do you think Lee is such a happy place?
It's still got that village feel about it.
You know,
it's a unity. Everyone seems to know everyone. You go up there on the Broadway and you'll always bump into someone. You could spend a whole morning just bumping into people.
And everybody says he is the happiest man in town.
As I'm laying out my fish counter in the morning, every single person who walks past me on the road says hello and says good morning to me. Such a nice atmosphere. Everybody is friendly.
I've walked in to Osborne's and Sons. It's a fishmonger right on the water's edge. Pat Foychick is preparing five beautiful sea bass. They're bright, shiny and look absolutely delicious. The economy's not in great shape, but this is a business that is actually managing to grow in difficult conditions.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, we base it on quality and service. If people are getting quality, they're going to come back and they're going to keep spending more money.
Lay-on-Sea isn't the wealthiest area, so what's the town doing right? Helen Simmons is acting town clerk. I met her in the community centre when a puppet show had just finished.
There are areas of the town that are quite deprived. We try and look out for our residents and do what we can. There are initiatives that are going on at the moment. The Coastal Communities Group is a massive thing, regular meetings, looking for investment. And, yeah, we just look at other leisure facility type things that we can get everybody involved in. There are some very well-off areas within Lay and others not so well-off, and it's trying to find that balance so that everybody is happy.
And do you feel as though you've found that balance?
Not totally, probably, but still working on it.
I've seen a lot of smiles today, but not everyone loves the place. Actress Helen Mirren once called it the armpit of England. And I was interested to hear what the locals thought about that assessment.
She's such a great actress. They're very proud of the fact that she came from Lay-on-Sea. The locals feel that what she said was not very nice.
I wasn't very happy when she said about that. It's a lovely little fishing village that we live in, and she should be proud of her roots, so she should be sort of putting us on the map, but she didn't really do that.
Maybe it's after she became famous and got a lot of money, and by comparison to what she's now used to, it is the armpit of England, but I love it to bits and I wouldn't want to leave it. It's home, isn't it? You love your home, don't you?
So make your mind up from the start.
That was Elizabeth Hodson with our partners at the BBC.
And then you will find you're on the road to happiness. There's really nothing to it. Anyone can tell.
And that's our show for this week. I'll be back again next week as Lizzie continues a reporting trip. She's looking at the state of student loans. Speaking of which, next week we'll be hearing your stories about money and education. Are you spending on yourself? Are you splurging on your kids? What have you learned or figured out? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, or you can chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page. Do a search for Marketplace Business News. Or call us at 1-800-648-5114. And your voice may be featured on the air, so be nice. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Cerise Castle. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, and until next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.